Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. Today on our show, we'll continue our conversation with Colin Schwartz on federal guidelines for menu labeling. We'll hear about a farm community facing water shortages, beekeepers harvesting honey, and a tasty recipe featuring fresh beets from Chef Daniel Orr. All coming up on Earth Eats. Lou Ann Johnson has our news this week.
Hi, Kate. Isolated areas of Puerto Rico still remain without food since Hurricane Maria struck on September 20. Food and Environment Reporting Network's Ag Insider reported this week that even in areas of San Juan, people were rationing supplies. The USDA says it's delivering aid boxes to an estimated 500,000 households across the country and is delivering food to shelters for an estimated 11,000 people displaced in the disaster. The agencies also lifted restrictions on food stamp benefits and special programs for women, infants, and children, which includes granting a waiver that allows island food stamp recipients to purchase hot food at stores through the end of November. Hot foods are normally off limits for the nutritional assistance program. About 40% of the island's population depends on food stamps, but most of the country still remains without power to prepare meals. The 2018 Farm Bill is expected to remain largely unchanged if the Senate Budget Committee gets its way. That's good news for some, like SNAP recipients, though the House package calls for a $10 billion cut in food stamps over a decade. SNAP and other nutrition benefits account for about 85% of Farm Bill spending. But with no cuts to the Senate's version of the bill also comes no additions, something farm groups and allies have advocated for in the 2018 bill, in the form of higher crop insurance and safety nets for farmers. According to Representative Colin Peterson from Minnesota, the prices are making it difficult for anyone to make money in any aspect of agriculture, and the safety nets in place are inadequate to offset what's happening in the marketplace. The Farm Bill goes up for renewal every 4 or 5 years. The last Farm Bill from 2014 isn't set to expire until September of 2018, but Congress must act now to prepare next year's budget for the $100 billion per year Farm Bill. The House aims to hold a floor vote for their budget plan Wednesday, the same day the Senate expects to clear its package for a floor vote. And the hum of coal mining machines will soon be replaced by the buzz of bees in southern West Virginia. The New York Times this week reported on the nonprofit Appalachian Headwaters, an organization that reclaims degraded waterways and landscapes while providing economic and entrepreneurial opportunities to former coal miners, including honey production, bee colony sales, and native plant cultivation. Kate Asquith, program director at Appalachian Headwaters, told the New York Times that what might start as a side hustle for some people could turn into a true income over time, something that could sustain a family. It's in an area of the country that Deborah Delaney, assistant professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware, says is perfect for a honeybee and native plant enterprise. The land is mostly covered by forests, which aren't threatened by the pesticides that plague insects in industrial farm areas. The apiary program is young, but so far they have about 86 hives. Next spring, the program hopes to distribute about 150 hives to 35 beekeepers, either for free or through a low or no interest loan.
Thanks, Luann.
No problem, Kate.
And thanks to Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard for this week's news stories. We've got another story about beekeeping and a sweet honey recipe coming up later on our show. Water is a vital resource, especially on the farm fields that grow our food. But across the Great Plains, many farm communities face dwindling water supplies. In southern Colorado, that spurred farmers to take up a bold experiment. We sent Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon to see if it's working.
So just to orient you, I figured
Heather Dutton drives her silver SUV near the farm where she grew up in Colorado's San Luis Valley. Today, she runs a water conservancy district, and we're close to the valley's center, just about to pull into the town of Center.
So we get an average, especially here in Center, we get an average of 7 inches of rain a year. So it's a high mountain desert, even though it's all nice and cool and feels great. It's a desert.
If you look at the valley from above, you can see what she means. The flat expanse of the valley floor is dusty and brown, except for a grid of circular farms. They're green and lush.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, you?
Pretty good. Morning. Hi there.
At the farm, Dutton's father, Doug Messick, comes out to meet us. He's wearing a ball cap and a plaid shirt tucked into work pants. We're standing at the edge of a field of his potatoes. They're russets, the kind you'd use for a loaded baked potato.
So you can see here, we got our water meter.
Dozens of nozzles hang from a rotating arm above the potato plants, spraying them with perfect little water droplets. It's what keeps the fields green. Messick pumps water from a shallow aquifer under our feet. Today, there's enough water to keep it running, but during a drought 15 years ago...
The aquifer was declining, but nobody really started noticing until they started sucking air instead of water back in the early 2000s.
That actually happened?
Yes.
The water basically ran out. Suddenly, the valley's seemingly endless supply of groundwater was finite. Neighbors argued about who was to blame. Farmers panicked, and state regulators threatened to swoop in.
We couldn't sit back and just pump to the bottom of the aquifer. The schools, the hospitals, the communities would not survive.
Cleve Simpson runs the Rio Grande Water Conservation District, which manages water in the valley.
If we don't act, we might not be here as early as the next 10 years. So it's not like something that's going to happen 100 years from now.
For farmers, the options were simple. Keep pumping until everyone's supplies ran out and the state shut off their wells, or find a way to cut back. After years of court cases and infighting, the farmers made a painful decision. They agreed that to save their livelihoods, everyone had to pay more money for water.
When you have to start paying for water, which is what they agreed to do, assess themselves a fee for the water they pumped, it incentivizes conservation efforts because it hits your pocketbook directly.
For 6 years now, farmers have been paying more every time they turn on their pump, 3 or 4 times more. That can be tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars each year just for water. It was the first time here in the U.S. that a group of farmers did something like this, and no one really knew if it would work.
We were able to determine that effectively, yes, they've been able to reduce their groundwater extraction pretty substantially.
Kelsey Cody is part of a University of Colorado research team that looked at that question. Here's what they found. Farmers cut their pumping by 30%, and farms aren't closing up shop because of the high cost.
I want you to think you can't make it.
Back at farmer Doug Messick's potato field, he pulls a few spuds out of the ground.
Oh, looky there! Tubers!
He's getting close to harvest time, his big payday for an entire year of work.
So yeah, it seems stupid to actually tax yourselves and cost yourself more money, but the big picture is you stay in business and you keep your community whole and everybody gives a little.
This way, rather than a few bearing the cost of a water shortage, everyone's in it together. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
You can find more at harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Last week, we spoke with Colin Schwartz with the Center for Science in the Public Interest about the new federal guidelines for menu labeling. He explained that new rules were set to take effect earlier this year, requiring food service chains to include a calorie count next to each item on their menus. The Trump administration delayed implementation of the new law, and it now appears to be set to take effect in May of 2018. I spoke with Schwartz about the details and the significance of the new law.
Calories are the big part of menu labeling. What you'll see when you're shopping and dining out are the calories posted right next to the price and the name of the food item.
So why is it important to have access to the caloric information right there at the point of decision making?
More and more Americans are eating prepared foods and not cooking. The vast majority of studies have shown that when you do this, when you give customers an informed choice and they know how many calories are in their food, they then are able to compare options. And studies show that we do pick lower calorie options when we have that information available. And that, of course, contributes to healthier eating, which allows you to stay healthy and prevent developing any sort of chronic disease related to poor diet. What's interesting also, what we've seen, is that when you have calories posted, you'll have more healthful options now offered. So restaurants actually come out with lower calorie items now that they have to post the calories in their items. We see restaurants and supermarkets and convenience stores already labeling, and we hear from customers that they're using it. So despite the law being delayed by another year, we know that it is making an impact in the day-to-day lives of many Americans. And in the long term, we know that it can actually reduce healthcare costs and keep us healthy by allowing us to be able to eat better when we eat out.
So can you talk a little bit about what the current threats are to keeping these standards in place?
Yep. So never a dull day in D.C. Despite Trump administration having delayed the law by a year, and recently actually the FDA Commissioner Gottlieb said that menu labeling is here to stay, that the administration is actually moving toward their deadline. They're not looking to actually weaken the requirements. So even hearing that from the Trump administration, that menu labeling is here to stay, we still have threats in Congress. And it comes from some industry groups, particularly Domino's Pizza, that still doesn't really want to label calories in their pizza. They don't want their customers to know how caloric their pizza is.
A bill has come forward in Congress called the Common Sense Nutrition Disclosure Act. In essence, it weakens the law by carving out exceptions and changing requirements to where and how caloric information is posted. But Schwartz feels confident about the law going forward.
Industry has already invested in this. They know that menu labeling is not going away. You know, there might be these shenanigans in D.C. from the administration or from Congress that some industry groups like Domino's is still pushing to weaken or delay menu labeling. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of the public, over 80% of Americans, want this, have wanted it for some time. So this is not going away.
That was Colin Schwartz, speaking with us by phone from the Center for Science in the Public Interest in Washington, D.C. Check our website for links to more information about the menu labeling law, eartheats.org. Time of year, most beekeepers are busy getting their hives ready for winter. Back in mid-August, I attended a honey sling in Bedford, Indiana. No, people were not slinging honey at each other as I first imagined. In fact, it's a honey extraction event. This one was organized by the Bedford Beekeepers Club.
Hi there!
Morning! Lower her car door.
Curtis McBride hosts the event in his shop, a large warehouse-style building with two industrial fans running nonstop. McBride is the founder of the Beekeepers Club.
Well, I've had bees for years and years, but really got back into it since I retired teaching. I taught school for 34 years, and so I retired from that and really got back into it more. My grandfather had bees when I was a little kid. Of course, he died when I was 12, and they sold all of his equipment, so I didn't get any more experience with them after that, but always liked them, enjoyed being around them, but I didn't have anybody to learn from. There was nobody around who knew how to keep bees. And so once I got back into it this time, one of my former students, he had a few bees and he wanted to learn more. So we decided, why don't we just form a club? And we did, but anybody's welcome to come. There's no charge for the club membership. Only thing is, you know, just if we have some event going on, we'd like people to help us with it. We'll have a bee school in January. The last Saturday in January, we always have a school there. Last 2 years, we've had over 100 people.
The club also offers a bee intensive at the Lawrence County Fairgrounds every year, with hands-on beekeeping workshops and guest speakers from around the country. They share equipment and hold events like this honey sling. They also order packages of bees in bulk.
200 packages of bees in this past year from California for people in our club. We brought in 200 last year and 100 the year before that. So there's some hives getting started around.
Club members Teresa Moon and her son Adam Brown are fairly new to beekeeping.
I'm Teresa Moon here with my son Adam Brown, and we do the honey stuff together. We didn't get any honey until last year. That was our first year getting honey. We started out with two hives, and we had a lot of swarms the first year, so you know, learning and not really knowing what we were doing. Thank goodness we have Kurt and people like him to help us, who are willing to answer newbie questions.
The process of extracting honey is fairly straightforward. But first, you have to get the honey supers, the part of the hive with all the honey in it, from the bee yard to McBride's shop. Adam Brown explains the process.
We sprayed honey begone on a felt board, fume board, and place it on top of the hive, and they don't like that honey begone. It's an all natural, I'm not sure what exactly is in it.
They just don't like it, they'll go away from it.
And the bees moved down, plus I smoked them a little bit to try to get them to move down, and left it on there about 5 minutes or so, and then kind of shook the box, tried to shake them out of it.
And then most of them are gone by that point. So then you put them in your truck, or what did you do?
I took them and stored them in her garage, stacked them up and covered them up to keep the bees out of them. I done that Wednesday and Thursday, and then we loaded them up this morning and brought them over here.
Once they arrive at the shop on Saturday morning, they start by uncapping the honeycomb.
Uncapping honey frames. You gotta take the... scrape the caps off so that the honey can be extracted.
What's the tool that you're using for that?
A knife and what's this thing called? Scraper.
Next, they load the frames into a large metal cylinder with a wheel-type structure in the center. The frames clip onto the wheel. Once all the frames are loaded, they close the lid, start up the motor, and the center wheel begins to spin.
An extractor, it holds 9 of the frames. What it does, it's a centrifuge, and it'll spin it and spin the honey out. The bees build in these combs. The bees aren't straight in, the lines aren't. They're actually tilted just a little bit, the wax is, to hold the honey in till they get it cured out. Once it's dry, that's when we, and it's capped, that's when we take it and extract it. Sling that honey out. And when we do several of them to get separated, we'll open this valve and drain it out.
Teresa Moon is on the other end of the shop cleaning buckets.
The buckets that sp- spigot that opens, the strainers will fit right into this, and then the strained honey will go into the buckets. And then we can use these to put the honey in jars.
The buckets are your typical white 5-gallon food grade, but these have sturdy spigots on the bottom for getting the honey into the jars.
The Beekeeper Club has just been great. I mean, you know, we've got all the equipment everybody needs, you know, if you're just starting out and you don't have to. The first time we tried to extract any honey, we just thought if we cut the caps off of it and let it drain, it would work, but it really didn't. We ended up with very little honey, so. And everybody's really nice, works together, you know.
Sharing equipment is one of the advantages of joining a beekeeping club like this one. The knowledge sharing is also important. As any beekeeper knows, there are many things that can threaten a hive. Lately, a destructive pest called a varroa mite has been a big concern for beekeepers across the country. I asked Moon if the varroa mite has been a problem for them this year.
Yeah, they're a big problem. You can just barely see them, so sometimes you don't know you've got them until it's kind of too late. But we treat twice a year in the spring, and we treat in the fall before the winter. Some people don't, kind of survival of the fittest kind of thing, but I don't know. Some of this stuff is brought in from other countries and it wouldn't be here naturally. So I feel like the bees, they need a little help, you know. We'll help them.
Teresa Moon has plans for her honey.
My husband puts it in his coffee. We put it in tea in the wintertime especially. I make a kind of an herbal tea whenever we've got a cold and put lemon and honey in it. And that's kind of our cough drop, soothy cough drop kind of thing. We use it for that. And then I make a granola too that I used to sell at the Orleans Farmers Market, but now that I'm not really doing that anymore, I make it at Christmas time for family. Honey and oatmeal, you know, oatmeal honey, brown sugar is that one. And then there's another one I make that has maple syrup and pecans.
Well, it must be exciting to be getting this much honey.
Yeah. We're happy to be getting this much honey.
In case you're having a hard time picturing it, you can see photos of the honey extractor on our website, eartheats.org. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a single show. We heard from Teresa Moon about what she likes to make with honey. Chef Daniel Orr has another idea. He's making a vibrant vinaigrette featuring honey and one of his favorite root vegetables.
A lot of people don't like beets because they say they taste like dirt. And they do have a very earthy flavor, but I love them. And it's just important that you do clean them off really well. We're going to rinse them under cold water. We're going to trim off the tops. Now the tops are just as good as the roots, so don't throw those away. A lot of people tend to just discard the tops of the beets, but they're great sautéed. You can make any kind of a stewed greens dish with the beet greens. You know, you can cook them down with some onions and garlic and a little bit of olive oil and slow cook them until they're very tender, or you can do a very quick little sauté where you just you make a little, heat up your pan, add a little bit of garlic to it, let it start to turn nutty and brown. Quickly add your greens, a little bit of water, and that will help them steam. And within a minute or two, you have a really nice beet greens dish. All right, so now we're going to trim up the beets. We're going to roast them in the oven until they're very tender. And once they are tender, you can puncture them with a knife. Then they'll be ready to make the vinaigrette. I've got my beets ready right here. Again, very tender. When I stick the knife into it, it releases. It feels very, very soft. We're just going to cut off the top and the bottom and peel them. The way we're going to accentuate the flavors of this beet is with some orange, some honey, and some ginger, some of my favorite flavors, and it really kind of rounds off that what some people call dirty flavor that beets have, and makes them a little more universally loved, should we say. Now, I'd say we've got probably about a half cup of beets. We're going to add the juice of one orange, a little bit of orange zest as well. I would put about a quarter of a cup of honey in there. Okay, we're going to add some olive oil. To this, we're going to add about a half cup. A little pinch of my sweet seasoned spice blend, which you could also use a little cinnamon, a little nutmeg in there. And we're going to add 2 cloves of garlic and just a little bit of water, about a quarter cup of water. Okay, a pinch of salt. And for our acid, we're going to use a little vinegar. You could use some cider vinegar would be fine, or just white vinegar, and put about a quarter cup in there. If you wanted it spicy, you could add a little bit of chili pepper.
You'll find this recipe and hundreds of others on our website, eartheats.org.
Okay, gonna just put the blender on. Now you see, it has a nice thick viscosity to it, coats the spoon, that's what you're looking for. This is also great with goat cheese. So you could do a salad with goat cheese and then put a little bit of this sprinkled on top, drizzled on top, and have a wonderful dressing. You can use it for all kinds of things.
I really like it over lightly steamed asparagus spears. Thanks to Chef Daniel Orr for that recipe. I'm Kate Young. All of our recipes are archived at eartheats.org. And be sure to look for us on Twitter at Earth Eats. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery, dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. A huge thank you to the Earth Eats crew, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Luann Johnson, Casey Zakin, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm your host, Kate Young.